Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, if you stop and think about it, depending on a child's age and what kind of activity they do, my estimates from reading a little bit, and we can ask our expert today, but they can breathe in anywhere between 5 and maybe 30 liters per minute. I think that's probably outside of the newborn or the infant area, but that's quite a bit of air that they're exchanging back and forth. And what is in that air can affect our health, and it also can contribute to disorders like asthma. So what our topic is today is pediatric lung disorders and air quality. My guest is a pediatric pulmonologist, Dr. Henry Ewan, and he is currently Dr. Harry Ewan. I'm sorry about that. I messed that up on one of my pieces of paper, I noticed. Dr. Ewan is currently the medical director of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at the Children's Hospital at Providence in Anchorage, Alaska. Dr. Ewan, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Woodard. Thank you for inviting me.
So I think it's fair that if you have any questions related to pediatric lung health, and he also does sleep medicine, as you may have just heard. So if you have questions like that, don't hesitate to give us a call. This is how you can get in touch with us. Our local number is 550-8433. Let me give you that again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and we are also available during the next hour or so by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Those of you who listen, you should know how to do this with the email, but those of you who are new, you spell that out, line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Ewan, what I would like to do is start with asthma. We've talked about asthma many times in the during time I've done this program, mainly, I think, from an adult standpoint and also from an allergy standpoint. However, asthma is much more, at least to my mind, than just allergy. So I think it's a good opportunity to talk about it from a pediatric pulmonology standpoint. So let's start with the basics like I like to do. How would you tell me, define to me, help me as a listener understand what asthma is?
So asthma is a condition that affects the airways, and there are four main features of asthma. The first one is there is inflammation that occurs in the airways. There is increased secretions. There is bronchoconstriction, and usually what sets asthma aside from other lung diseases like COPD is that it is mostly reversible with the appropriate medications.
Are there, I'm not sure how to get into this topic, are there different kinds of asthma? Nowadays, I think most individuals recognize that when we talk about diabetes, there's a type 1 and there's a type 2. But really, for sophisticated physicians, people really in the know, there's actually multiple different pathways by which people can develop diabetes besides just the classic type 1 and type 2. So is asthma a disorder like that? And if so, can you help me understand what we're talking about?
So with asthma, there are several ways to categorize asthma. One way is by the type of trigger that some asthmatics are sensitive to. So, for example, people may have heard of exercise-induced asthma. There's allergic asthma, nocturnal asthma. So those are categorized mainly by what the triggers are. Another way to categorize asthma is by specifically the symptom. So even though most asthmatics may present with wheezing, for those who don't wheeze, there you may have heard of a category called cough variant asthma. And lastly, as pulmonologists, we also categorize asthma based on the severity. So whether it's a intermittent asthma, a persistent asthma, and within the persistent category, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So one perception I'm going to say a lot of people have is that all asthma is due to allergy. And you would answer that question by saying true or false?
It is mostly true.
Okay.
But there are asthmatic patients who do not have allergens, sensitivities to allergens. So, for example, there are asthmatics out there who are only affected by exercise. The type of reaction in the airways are still very similar to those affected by allergens, but they themselves are not affected by allergens. I've seen patients that are only affected by weather change or temperature change. But a lot of asthmatics are sensitive to particular allergens, but not always.
I want to come back and ask, what are the most common triggers? You've used that word triggered and emphasized that sometimes it's nighttime. You said sometimes it may be exercise. Sometimes it might be some irritant to affect cold air. You mentioned in weather changes, which it seems unusual, but it seems very true. But what would you say are the most common symptoms of asthma? You've mentioned that wheeze is present, but you've mentioned that you don't necessarily have to have wheeze. So.
Correct. So if you look at the classic presentation of asthma, normally they present with coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, sometimes with chest tightness, chest pain. Those are all classic presentations of asthma. Now, however, at one of the deceiving features of asthma is that very rarely do all the symptoms present in someone that has asthma. So there are a lot of asthmatics out there who only cough, but they don't wheeze or have shortness of breath. There are asthmatics out there who cough and wheeze, but don't have shortness of breath. I've even seen patients who only present with chest pain, but mm-hmm. no shortness of breath, coughing, or wheezing. Mm-hmm. So the presentation can be very deceiving, and this is one of the reasons why asthma may be difficult to diagnose, because most asthmatics don't present alike.
Mm-hmm. So that was another issue that I wanted to get to, is this variability, which makes things confusing. There's variability among patients, between patients, I should say, and then there's quite a bit of variability over the lifespan of patients as far as symptoms and how much it affects their life, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So, you know, a lot of families come to me to the question or wonder whether their child has asthma because they have a neighbor, they have a relative who has asthma, but, you know, their child doesn't present the same way that their relative does. And again, this is one of the deceiving things about asthma. As common as asthma is, it doesn't always present the same way. So for example, if somebody has osteoarthritis, you know, everybody with osteoarthritis probably present very similarly, if not identical. But with asthmatics, they can vary quite a bit in how they present, the frequency of symptoms. And so when parents compare how their child presents to somebody they know, a relative, a friend, they may question whether they have the child has asthma or not, because they just don't look the same.
Mm-hmm. So, and again, I was somewhat distracted, I suspect, when I was asking you this question, and I have my own answer, but I want to make sure it's right. Is the most common symptom of asthma is probably not recurrent wheeze, which is that high-pitched expiratory kind of sound, but it's recurrent cough. Is
yes.
that fair to say?
Yes, I agree. The probably the most common presenting symptom is cough.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the wheeze may not even be present when a physician sees somebody in the office. It may be more likely to occur outside of the office situation.
Yes. So I see quite a few patients that are perfectly fine when they are in clinic seeing me. But based on the history presented by the parents, you get a sense of whether they do have asthma or not.
So what would be that history? I mean, so recurrent cough, particularly early in childhood, is pretty common. And that leads to this whole issue of when you can make the diagnosis of asthma, particularly in children. And also it leads to the idea that the diagnosis has been delayed, particularly in childhood. So what are you looking for? What are the kind of questions you ask? What are the kind of responses you're looking for to help you feel comfortable?
Well, in a lot of literature, a lot of times they talk about making the diagnosis using pulmonary function testing. Obviously, with children that are too young to follow directions, that type of testing may not be realistic. But over time, and other literatures have also mentioned that whether they respond to steroids, namely systemic steroids, is a good way to make the diagnosis. And in fact, the NIH guidelines states that you can make a diagnosis of asthma at any age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess when I was doing a lot of childhood asthma, it was very common to see a child who was typically a boy, because they are, as I recall, twice as likely to cough and wheeze and get that diagnosis as girls early in life, who came in with the question is, why does my child have recurrent pneumonia? How does that figure in?
Well, in terms of, gender differences, usually before the age of 20, males tend to be more affected with asthma than females. And between the ages of 20 to 40, the incidence is about the same. And from 40 years on, females tend to be more affected by asthma than males. The suspicion for this type of distribution is mainly the size of the airway. Based on the different stages of development. So the suspicion is that females have a larger airway than males as children. And as people get older, the size of the airway is increased for the male gender and less so for the female gender.
And what about the issue of why has my child got recurrent pneumonia and often that ends up being asthma? How does that figure in? How does that happen?
Well, the most common cause of pneumonia in children is actually uncontrolled asthma. So when I see a patient who presents to me with recurrent pneumonias, oftentimes that's one of the first things I think about. Usually the pneumonia is a result of persistent increased secretion in the lungs that isn't adequately being cleared. And with inflammation going on as well, it makes the airways narrower, which again adds to the problem of airway clearance. Mm-hmm. And so when you have secretions building up over time, it creates a good environment for bacteria to grow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was my experience also. And what I heard you say, I think is important for listeners, is that when children get a diagnosis of recurrent pneumonia, particularly in today's environment where immunizations have been so successful in knocking out some very significant causes of pneumonia, that somebody should be very alert as that's probably not normal, and that it may be that this is really truly not the underlying problem is pneumonia or immune deficiency or so forth, but an asthma-like situation that's not been recognized.
Right, that's true. And by no means are all patients with recurrent pneumonias due to asthma. But when I work up a patient with recurrent pneumonia, that's usually at the top of my list. And as time goes on, if asthma doesn't seem to explain adequately the symptoms, then I would look towards other types of causes.
What's the natural history of asthma over time? And where I'm going with this is to help listeners understand, the common question is, will I outgrow asthma, which any pediatric physician has been asked a number of times. So how do we answer that, and how do we know how to answer that question?
So in order to talk about progression, I usually like to start with the beginning of asthma. So with anybody can get asthma at any age, even though it's a condition that's much more commonly diagnosed in children. And there are really two ways to get asthma. One is through the increased likelihood from a genetic standpoint. So for those folks, they have family members that also have asthma. The other way is through infections. Certain infections have been known to reshape the architecture of the airway and resulting in a person getting asthma. So, and this is regardless of whether there's family, any family history of asthma. So once a person gets asthma, the disease itself can fluctuate in terms of severity. So if they have moderate asthma to begin with, over time, the moderate severity can worsen to a severe asthma, or it may improve to a milder asthma. And this is regardless of what type of medication they've been on, whether they're compliant with the medications. That's just how asthma behaves. So it's not surprising that for some children, they may need medications when they start off. And as they get older, they may need less and less of it. It's also not surprising that over time, the medication that they've been taking may be inadequate. So one of the goals of treating asthma is really to monitor when these changes occur so that we can adjust the treatment for it to fit the severity at the time.
Let me remind listeners just real quickly. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
No.
My guest today is Dr. Harry Yuen. He's director of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at the Providence Alaska Medical Center. We're talking about pediatric lung disorders, and want to bring in air quality when we can and air quality issues. We've mainly been talking about asthma. But we're welcome any kind of questions or comments that any listener would like to make. And I have not taken the time to give those contact numbers again, so let me do that right now. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll both be here through close to 3 o'clock local time if you've got questions or comments. So to kind of repaint this picture a little bit for listeners, is there's four things that are going on in the airways of the lung, which I like to, people may have heard of as a respiratory tree. It's kind of a trachea, is that the trunk upside down and your tree branches down into your lung, they get smaller and smaller, and there's lots of mucus or secretions. The airway may tighten down, particularly under injury or inflammation, makes it more sensitive. And then there's swelling of that airway, and then you said it's reversible. So depending on how each of those four factors are interacting at any one time, people may have just cough and shortness of breath, cough and wheeze. That can change over time. It can change depending on what the trigger is, your age, and so forth. So that helps to help us understand that variability that goes on. And then you said also there's that group of people who really may be fine early in life, not like most asthmatics, and then suddenly they get some infection in adolescence or adulthood, and they become asthmatic again.
Yes, exactly.
And that also, because my understanding is also true, that airway size, when you're smaller, the airway sizes are smaller, you can wheeze a little easier, you can get short of breath a little easier, may help explain why as kids get older, their symptoms get a little bit easier to manage. Their symptoms maybe not as much as they used to be. And we hear this story, oh, I have outgrown my asthma, until you ask them some important question like, what happens when you get a cold? Do you wheeze? Oh, yeah, but not like I used to is usually the next thing. Or what happens when you really do some aerobic activity? What happens then? Oh, yeah, I start wheezing or coughing, particularly after I stop that activity. Does that help? Does that make sense? Is that your experience as well? And that so that asthma situation may actually always be there. It just improves based on some physical factors.
Yes, yes, that's definitely true. The other explanations as to why as adults, a person may not have as many episodes as they did when they were children, aside from airway size, would be how often they get sick. So, you know, we know that, excuse me, we know that upper respiratory illness is a very common trigger for asthma. In fact, it's the most common trigger of all the triggers. And so as children, we tend to be catching things more often, much more often than we do as an adult. So with one less trigger, that may explain why as an adult we don't necessarily have as many asthmatic episodes. And lastly, there are some people that truly outgrow asthma. Mm-hmm. And even though there is no way to predict who will and who won't, there are studies that show certain factors making it more or less likely. So, for example, there's studies that show if a person has environmental allergens as a trigger, they are more likely to outgrow asthma. The more severe the asthma, the less likely they'll outgrow it. And if they have history of eczema, they are less likely to outgrow it. So these are some things in studies that have suggested which folks are more likely to outgrow it as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don, you're one of the first callers we've got. Let's take your question. What can we do for you?
Well, this goes in tandem with what the gentleman was just speaking about. I was raised during the 40s. Most of our furnaces and heating, particularly in the wintertime, are coal. Some of them switch over to oil after that, even more so being in northern Ohio. A lot of them switched over to gas. By the time it got into the 1960s, I was well into my 20s, and I was involved in scuba diving exercises in compressed air and whatnot. So my connection is with respect to these triggers. Would the effect of that being related to, say, carcinogens from various types of heating fuels, fossil fuels in particular, as compared to, say, heating with electricity?
Yes. So you've hit it right on. There are numerous studies that look at air pollutants as to how much it affects asthma, and it's pretty clear from these studies that the air quality is directly associated with how well people do when they have asthma. So when you mentioned that when you were younger, your house was heated with coal and other types of solid fuel, those types of pollutants that are a result of burning these fuels can definitely trigger asthma.
Okay, thank you very much. Do appreciate it.
All right, thanks for your call, Don. Dr. Yuen, the way I think about this is that inflammation on your skin causes pain. Inflammation in your airways, your lungs, doesn't really cause a lot of pain. It causes the airway to contract down. That's the protective reflex, if you will, versus pain. And so allergens, cold air, sheetrock dust, perfume, smoke, particulates, all those things are doing multiple things. Some may be triggering a little inflammation. Some may be the wool on your scraped arm, so to speak. The symptom is not pain. The symptom is getting shortness of breath and mucus and then the airway swelling. So it's like that airway is oversensitive in a sense, and whether the initial trigger is or the original problem is allergy, genetics, or what, it can be very difficult to decipher out. As you said, some people have no trouble till they get an infection, and for some reason they act asthmatic, and then others may be unusual, maybe only triggered when they're around a cat, but often they still colds are their biggest trigger. So it's this sensitivity of the airways for some reason that really starts driving everything.
Right. And what's interesting is the sensitivity may be very specific. So I recall seeing a patient who has asthma, but her only trigger is the smell of cinnamon. So anytime anybody, making apple pie or, go to a candle store, she has an exacerbation. But there's really nothing else that makes her asthma flare up except the smell of cinnamon.
Right. That goes along with why in the world would the barometric pressure changes with a thunderstorm induced asthma? So if you were in the Midwest for a while, I've seen what I thought was similar things when I was doing a lot of asthma work up here, not with thunderstorms necessarily, but with fronts moving in. Is there a reasonable explanation for that kind of trigger?
Well, in terms of weather changes and as an asthma trigger, there's no clear study that can explains the association. We do know that weather change can be a trigger, but the suspicion is that it's not necessarily the weather itself, it's the change in temperature. Whether it's going from a colder temperature to a warmer one, or vice versa. So the speculation is that some people have a sensitivity to this type of a weather change. Another possible explanation is if the rain and the thunderstorm happens to occur at around springtime, it may trigger more pollen count and things flying in the air that could that people could be sensitive to.
Okay. All right. We are moving ahead fast as usual. We're already halfway through this program. I've got to take a short break. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Once again, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion of pediatric lung diseases, particularly asthma and air quality, with Dr. Harry Ewan. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about pediatric lung disorders like asthma and also how air quality may affect health, including some common diseases like asthma. Our guest is pediatric lung specialist, also known as a pulmonologist, Dr. Harry Ewan. And you can reach us with questions and comments during the next 30 minutes now by email at line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550 855-450-8433, and we have a toll-free number as well, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. We won't be able to help you at that particular time. So if you got questions or comments, this is the time to do it. I also promised to put a brief message out, which about a very, I think, a very important public presentation by Dr. Christopher Blodgett this Thursday. That's this Thursday from 2:30 to 4:30 at the Anchorage Library, the LUSAC Library, in the Assembly Chambers. Dr. Blodgett is a specialist on what we call adverse childhood experiences and the effects of which are becoming increasingly well understood to be lifelong in children, and how we can be better at creating trauma-informed communities that can lead to better outcomes in education, healthcare, criminal justice, and social services. So it's this Thursday, November 3rd, 2:30 to 4:30 at the LUSAC Library in the Assembly Chambers. If you want more information, here is the phone call to call, 248-7373, 248-7373, and say you'd like to get more information about Dr. Blodgett's presentation. Okay, we're back. We're talking about asthma. Let's talk just briefly. We've got a number of people who are called. We have a couple of phone messages, but let's talk briefly about treatment of asthma before we do anything else. Then we'll take some more phone calls and emails. What are our options for managing this rather variable, recurrent, often progressive, but not all, I mean, not progressive respiratory illness, which causes recurrent cough and wheeze, we call asthma.
So when I talk to family and patients about treatment for asthma, I usually start by saying that there are all the asthma medications out there fall under one of two categories. They're either considered a rescue medication, in which case they only use the medication when they have an active flare-up, or they're considered preventive medication, which is a medicine that they use daily, regardless of whether they're having a flare-up or not. And since there are a lot more options in the preventive category, we, as asthma providers, really emphasize people doing their preventive medications. Because once they have an active flare-up, then we have much fewer options to treat the asthma exacerbation. So within the preventive category, there are several other categories. So for example, one that is commonly used now is an inhaled steroid. So some of the names out there for inhaled steroids are Flovent, Qvar, Pulmicort. So inhaled steroids has been shown to be very effective in preventing asthma exacerbations as long as the treatment is adequate and it's used daily as recommended. However, it is not a very good medication if it's used as a rescue medication. And a lot of studies have looked at, you know, whether it's effective in a different role, and it's been shown that it's not. Other categories that fall into the preventive category, for example, would be Singulair, which is a also called Montelukast. And there's a long-acting beta agonist is another group. So bottom line is a lot of these preventive medications are trying to decrease inflammation, trying to increase the airway, trying to decrease the amount of mucus that's being produced. So all the features that come with asthma, that's the target of these preventive medications. They take much longer for the medication to be effective, which is why they don't do very well as a rescue medication. But in terms of the rescue medication, albuterol is very commonly used. And the effects of albuterol doesn't last very long, but it works much more quickly than preventive medications. And so that's one of the more commonly used rescue medications. And there are a lot of other, there are several other rescue categories that are mostly used as in if a person needs to be hospitalized for their asthma exacerbation. I mentioned a systemic steroid like prednisone earlier, and that is also considered a rescue medication.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take a couple of emails, and then I just saw a phone call came in that's going to be perfect setup for a home run that I want to be sure we have time to talk about also. This is a gentleman who says, my toddler was diagnosed with tracheomalacia and mild bronchomalacia. I'll let you define those terms, by bronchoscopy. I'll tell people that's taking an instrument looking down the lungs where we can actually see these airways. At 8 months of age, and had two big rounds of antibiotics because bacteria were found, pneumococci in particular. She's been on inhalers that you've mentioned just recently, albuterol and Flovent, since 3 months of age. Particularly worse, having reactive airway disorder, in quotes, and chronic croup, quotes, in the winter with respiratory colds. But she's had no issues and no need for inhaler use at all for the last 5 months. I would point out that's the summer. She's now three, so is it likely that she's outgrown this or just a lucky run because it was a mild winter? I'm not sure that this we're into the winter yet. Okay, so what's tracheomalacia, what's bronchomalacia, what's going on with this child?
Well,
is she outgrown it?
this is actually a very loaded question, but let me start by defining what those conditions are. So malacia is basically floppiness. So tracheomalacia and bronchomalacia, it refers to floppiness in the airways at a different part of the airway. Trachea being the main airway that's running down your throat before it branches to the right and left half of the lung. And bronchomalacia is are the airways that are further down after the branching of the two sides. So and direct visualization with the bronchoscope is the way to make these diagnoses. There are, just with it, with these diagnoses, there are different possible causes. So in infants, they may be due to immaturity of the cartilage in the airway. So there are some patients who have softer cartilage rings in these airways, which prevents the airway from having more of a shape. And so there's floppiness that can be a result of that. Now, if that's the cause of this floppiness, then this should be something that is will improve and resolve over time. As the child gets older, the cartilages will mature, and the floppiness should clear up. Now, other causes of softening or floppiness of the airways could be, for example, a chronic cough can exacerbate these conditions. If there is any kind of compression outside the airway that isn't resolved, then that compression can continue to press on the airway, resulting in a floppiness that doesn't clear up. So there are a number of other possible conditions that could lead to tracheal and bronchomalacia. Now, based on the listener's question, it sounds like the child is getting better over time. And so without having seen the patient, I would venture to say that the malacia may be just due to immaturity of the cartilage, which then, as the child gets older, it should resolve on its own. Now, it sounds like there may be also some degree of reactive airways disease that was diagnosed in the past. And if the reactive airways disease is well controlled, then that really is a separate issue that's different, that's aside from the malacia. But if the reactive airways disease is not well controlled and the patient has frequent coughing, that frequency of coughing could continue to make it difficult for the airways to take shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this was a small baby, really, really treated as if it was asthma. So there's no reason why a child, to make things more complicated for sometimes for physicians, is there's no reason why somebody with a floppy airway may not also have asthma and reactive airway disorder, chronic COOP. I'm going to go ahead and say is like chronic recurrent pneumonia is very suspicious of certainly something in these airways, and often asthma may be involved as well. And certainly they were treated that way and have gotten better. Whether it's age, whether it's improvement, whether it's lack of illness in the summertime or the medications in any one individual, it's very difficult to say.
Yes, yes, that's true. And, you know, the thing that makes it a little bit more complicated is that many of these conditions present with the same symptoms. So if a child has a cough, how much is a cough from croup versus from asthma, from something else that's going on?
All right, let's take another phone call. Melissa, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. I have my son growing up. He's now a freshman in college, but growing up, he's always had a recurrent cough that his doctor has given him albuterol, I believe, an inhaler for. He's also an athlete and refused to use it because he said, I don't have asthma. It's an issue that's an aside, but I noticed as he grew up that he had kind of the same cough that I've always had, which is a bit, you know, coughing in the morning, a little bit phlegmy, and my brother has it as well. So when he was also young in elementary school, my sister had a baby who was born with cystic fibrosis, and it was the first time that has shown in our family ever. So there was no history of cystic fibrosis. And unfortunately, she passed away as an infant. So I've always had this in the back of my mind. Is there any chance that aspects, because there's so much that's not known about cystic fibrosis, is there any aspect of, like a recessive aspect of cystic fibrosis showing in a persistent cough that's not necessarily asthma? Or are they related in any way?
So could he have a milder form of cystic fibrosis?
I guess that's the simplified version.
Good question, by the way. Okay.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Cystic fibrosis is a lung condition that can present very variably in terms of severity. So a lot of times you're not going to find two CF patients that have exactly the same severity. I've seen very mild CF patients that are not diagnosed until they're an adult. And I have also seen very young patients with CF that get sick at a very early age. This cystic fibrosis is a condition that is inherited genetically. Half the genes from each parent. So it's not clear whether there is any relationship between asthma and CF. We do know that some CF patients have asthma as well, but that's a small percentage of all the patients that have CF. One of the things about cystic fibrosis that's very different than asthma, besides what's actually happening in the lungs, is that CF is a condition that usually worsens over time in terms of lung functions. Now, granted, not all CF patients actually have lung problems, but for those that do, usually the decline in lung function progresses as they get older. So if a person has lung issues at a young age and they seem to actually get better as they get older, that would make it less likely for the person to have CF, even if the testing was never done. CF is a very unique disease that is very different than asthma. It basically affects the viscosity of the secretions in the body, whether the secretion is from the lungs or from certain hormones like the pancreas, the hormones that the pancreas produce, for example, or liver secretions. So, and that type of disease is different than asthma in terms of what's happening in the airways.
Thank you.
I would, yeah, let me, Diane, just a second. Let's. I'd like to add a comment. I want Dr. Ewan to correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's really important to understand if I was you as his as your son's mother, wondering about what's really going on now is there's no question that this could be mild variation of cystic fibrosis. But I would say the odds are vastly in favor of the fact that it's not mild cystic fibrosis and much more likely to be a mild asthma or some other cause of rather persistent cough, which usually relates to allergies in some way, I would say. But it should be very easy to tell the difference. And there are important reasons to figure this out for his offspring's health, for example, and his own. And so I didn't want you to go away thinking that there's a good chance this is cystic fibrosis. But I do want to have Dr. Ewan to edit my comments here, too.
Well, no. I don't think he has cystic fibrosis because we did do genetic testing.
Ah.
We went under the assumption that I did carry the gene. My husband had testing. He did not have it. So we know he doesn't have cystic fibrosis.
Gotcha.
I guess my question is, are there aspects of, you know, say I was a carrier that somehow...
Right.
That's the side that would maybe have him be more phlegmy than normal because of the side effects of cystic fibrosis.
It
sounds like what you're telling me is it's not at all related.
Right. Usually, you know, as a carrier, so if he inherited one half of the CF gene from one parent but not the other, usually carriers of CF do not present with any symptoms.
Okay. So if he or I both have a persistent cough, we just probably are allergic to something, and that's our similarity, not CF.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, that helps. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
All right, Melissa, sorry for calling you Diane, because it's Diane I want to talk to now. Diane, are you on line one?
I am. Thank you.
All right, what's your question?
Well, I have heard that some studies indicate that perhaps the rise in asthma in America or developed countries is because we keep too clean of the houses, although obviously they didn't include me in the studies. But what's the relationship if you have a newborn and you've got animals around? I guess if you were raised on the farm, they say that the people there have less asthma. So what's the relationship, and should you try and keep the dander away from newborns or just let them go play in it?
Yeah. How the heck are we going to prevent this problem, right? This is the home run question. You're serving up a big fat curveball. I think it's an excellent question. It's very, very important, and it leads to some of our best explanations is why we're having more allergic issues. But I'm going to let Dr. Ewan answer this question. So what about houses and cleanliness, especially early in life?
Well, so studies in the past have suggested that if a baby, if an infant is exposed to allergens later, that they are less likely to develop allergies. Those are kind of some of the conclusions that were made in past studies. But more recent studies have actually shown the reverse, which states that if infants are exposed to allergens sooner, they're actually less likely to be allergic to them. So, excuse me. So I guess the way to answer this question is, based on the more recent studies, one would expect that an infant who is exposed to dust, dogs, cats, trees, grass at a younger age
Peanuts,
correct, are less likely to be allergic. And that's also true for food as well. So when, you know, my training is not in allergies, so an allergist out there may have a slightly different opinion, but based on studies that I've read, it seems to suggest that we do want to expose infants to different allergens at an earlier age. And so I think the rise in asthma may be due to several reasons. One is if people were following the data, the results from older studies or from previous studies, then that may increase the number of asthmatics because those folks were exposed to allergens later in their childhood. Another possible reason is asthmatics may be more commonly, or they're more widely diagnosed as we know more and more about asthma. People are starting to recognize it a little more. So there may be an increase in diagnosis because of that as well. And thirdly, depending on where you live in the country, if the air quality continues to be poor, but the population has increased in that area, then that may very well increase the number of asthmatics as well.
What about cesarean rather as a factor, cesarean births rather than vaginal? Does that indicate an increase?
Well, there are no, from what I have found, there are no studies that suggest cesarean birth increases the risk of asthma. However, we do know that premature birth increases the risk of asthma. So if the cesarean birth is a result of the baby needing to be born prematurely, then that might lead to or increase the risk of asthma as the child gets older. So it may not actually be the method of birth. It may very well just be the gestational age at the time the baby was born.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So this whole issue, if people want to get into it in a deeper way, is called the hygiene hypothesis, which suggests that to kind of throw a little bit different spin on it than Dr. Ewan was saying, which is entirely correct, is that humans evolved around animals without antibiotics, getting parasites, having natural birth and kind of slop. And until, maybe we say 150, 200 years ago, and then somewhere subsequent to that, particularly in Western societies, the more developed the society was, we started noticing an increase in allergic diseases more and more rapidly associated with something about Western culture, which made people start looking. And there's definitely less allergy in kids who grow up in parts of Europe where they are still very much using not the traditional American farming community, but animals, and where there's a lot of animals, a lot of contact with animals and animal products. And it may not even be the allergen necessarily. It could be endotoxin. It could be a combination between allergen exposure and endotoxin, which is something present in the fecal material of animals. But anyway, something very, very early. And so the idea is that we don't get exposed early in life to things that used to stimulate our immune system right after birth. And as a consequence, our immune system now reacts to peanuts and cats and other things that it didn't. I threw in peanuts in the middle because there's increasingly very good evidence that earlier introduction than peanuts is preventative to developing peanut allergy. And the pediatricians and allergists are now moving quickly away from the recommendation to hold off on those things. I want to quickly point out, if you already are allergic, it is not necessarily true that you want to have increased exposures, however. That may make things worse. So it's prevention versus treatment. We've only got a couple of minutes, and I got one question here a 68-year-old, Dr. Yuen, I hate to hit you with this one, but it makes some sense even for the age groups that we see. 68-year-old, and I exercised regularly over a year ago. I began experiencing what I thought was shortness of breath while exercising aerobically twice during younger years in my 30s and 40s. I experienced athletically or exercise-induced asthma. The VA gave me pulmonary function tests, which said were normal. I sometimes have mild coughing. Is it possible that I still have asthma, or is this just normal age progression? So could you have... How could he figure out whether he's got exercise-induced asthma, even with normal pulmonary function studies? Or could it still be that?
Well, so, you know, that's a good question. So one of the things that there's several explanations for this. One is that the patient may have something else besides asthma. So there are other conditions out there that present with very similar symptoms as asthma that is only triggered by exercise. So, for example, there's a condition out there called exercise-induced bronchospasm, in which the airways spasm when a person exercises, but there are no features of asthma. So there's no inflammation, there's no increased secretions, but the spasming of the airway presents just like an asthma. They cough, they wheeze, they have shortness of breath. Another possible condition is vocal cord dysfunction. So that can be triggered by exercise alone, and it also presents with shortness of breath as well. So that's one possible explanation. The other possible explanation is that if this patient truly has asthma, some folks that I've seen in the past, especially with exercise as the only trigger, what could happen is the symptoms of asthma only presents itself when the intensity of the exercise is reached to a certain level. So, for example, I see quite a few high school folks who have difficulty breathing, but they tell me that during practice they're fine, but when they are competing, that's when they see the trigger. So obviously this is related to intensity of the exercise.
And so this can be a difficult diagnosis to make, but could be. And so one of the questions was, how extensively did they do these pulmonary functions? Did they do pulmonary function tests with exercise conditions? Because then you might miss a mild exercise-induced asthma. Is that true?
Right. So most pulmonary function testing is done stationary, mm-hmm. in which case, obviously, the person's not exercising. And if that's the case, the intensity may not be there to provoke the mm-hmm. symptoms. But if the pulmonary function testing was done with exercise, then the intensity of the exercise should have provoked the symptoms to present if it was done with enough intensity.
From a clinical standpoint, I've always asked, does it get worse 5 or 10 minutes after exercise ceases? Because that's when you see the dip in pulmonary function. Is that a reasonable way to suggest that this might be exercise-induced asthma, depending on when it happens, the exercise?
Yes. So the symptoms may not occur right away. It could occur even up to 30 minutes after exercise.
Okay. Thanks very much. This has been an enjoyable and very fast 1 hour, Dr. Yuen.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me.
My guest was Dr. Harry Yuen of Anchorage. He's the medical director of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at Providence Alaska Medical Center. If you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. On the next program, we're going to talk about pediatric endocrinology with Dr. Sidney Fenton. Why don't you join us next Monday for that? Eric Bork was today's audio engineer. He's also our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.